ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
She was called the most beautiful woman in the world.
She was extraordinarily beautiful. She had the perfect face in that, you know, it was completely symmetrical.
She has flawless pale skin, wavy brown hair parted in the middle, and that sort of sultry look in her eyes that black and white movie stars just kind of have. But there was this one image in particular from a 1941 movie where she seems almost otherworldly.
Where she is wearing an amazing kind of headdress that is lit up like kind of sparkling diamonds. She's almost like a princess in that, or a queen even. And so she was absolutely stunningly beautiful.
However, Hedy Lamarr was more than just a glittering star of Hollywood. She had this whole other side to her.
So one of the things about her was that she loved inventing. It was just a part of her character, a part of her creativity.
And it was that creativity that one day helped concoct an idea to help the Allies in the Second World War.
Beautiful Hollywood film star patents designed to sink German U-boats. Ha ha. Because, of course, you couldn't be clever and beautiful at the same time.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of how a young Jewish woman who was mistaken as just a glamorous actress pioneered a way to sink Nazi submarines. She was laughed off, she was ignored, and then her plans were picked up decades later and used for something that we now employ every day. Indeed, you might be using it right now to listen to this, and no one saw it coming. So, to begin, we are starting off in Hollywood. And I think when you think of Hollywood, particularly in like the 1930s and 40s, there's this image, it's glitz, it's glamour. But Hollywood, at this particular moment in time, is also a magnet for people on the run.
You have this huge influx of European emigres into Hollywood because, of course, this is the rise of fascism in Europe. And many people, particularly of Jewish origin, many of them were escaping Germany and, in her case, Austria, as best they could.
So this is Ruth Barton.
I am Professor Emeritus in the Department of Film in Trinity College Dublin. So I am a now retired lecturer in film studies. My area is Irish cinema, but I also dip in and out of biography writing, which is why we're here today, because a long time ago now, I wrote a biography of the film star Hedy Lamarr, which is kind of slightly off my interest list, but turned out to be a pretty amazing story.
So Hedy Lamarr, by and large, exists in memory as the glitzy film star I described at the beginning. However, her real story begins in Vienna, Austria. She was born in 1914 as Hedwig Kiesler.
Hedy Lamarr came from a very middle-class, educated Viennese Jewish family, largely secular. She was sent to school to be educated. Her mother was a pianist, a concert pianist, who'd given up her career when she had her child and resented having to give up her career too. So there was a sort of sense in the household around the value of art, the value of having a career. And also she was very close to her father, who was a bank manager. These are people with education, with a sense of opportunity.
So Hedwig is brought up in this educated, cultured household, and she grew up to be a pretty headstrong, I guess you'd say, young woman. There is this great tale of how she once forged a note to skip school so she could sneak onto a film set.
there was in Vienna at that time a burgeoning film industry. So she sneaks off and she goes to the film studio and she kind of hangs out and then she says, oh, you know, I could do some work with you. And so she gets a small part in Vienna. And in fact, she gets picked up by Max Reinhardt, who was a very celebrated theatre director of the time. And apparently it was actually he who first called her the most beautiful woman in the world, who then brings her to Berlin, where there was a huge film industry, and starts her working in Berlin. And she also appeared on stage in Vienna. And she was ambitious. She knew what she wanted.
In 1933, Hedwig was about 18 years old, and she starred in this film called Ecstasy. She played a frustrated bride who has an affair with a young man. And it was scandalous. She appears completely nude at one point and has what many regard as cinema's first on-screen female orgasm.
This made her notorious. It made the film notorious. Of course, it was, you know, largely banned in many different territories. She arrives in Hollywood with this reputation of being A, foreign, which makes her B, exotic, but C, sexy. Probably sexier than an American actor could imagine, because that sort of combination of exoticism, open sex, and foreignness were really titillating, I think, in the kind of Hollywood scene that she was walking into.
So before we go anywhere near Hollywood, though, there is a part of her story that we've kind of skipped over. She was she was famous in Europe, and lots of people were interested in her. And one of those people was a man by the name of Fritz Mandl.
Fritz Mandl was the first of Hedy's six husbands. She married him when she was a teenager. And yeah, he was a creep, basically. But he was also, you know, he was a very rich creep because he was
the worst kind.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can kind of see the attraction to some extent, but actually not even looking at him. He wasn't even a gorgeous creep. But aside from all that, he was very wealthy. He owned the munitions factory, very famous munitions factory, which he'd taken over from his father and really remade into a hugely successful business. And he also had no conscience. He didn't care who he sold his munitions to. He'd sell them to fascists. He'd sell them to both sides. He sold them to both sides on the Spanish Civil War. He sold them to the Italians. If the Americans had come knocking on the door, he'd have sold them to the Americans. He made himself very, very wealthy until the Germans occupied Austria, at which point he had to flee. But prior to that, Hedy had already, she was kind of a trophy bride. She was very young, very beautiful. She was famous from stage.
Around the time they marry, that controversial movie, Ecstasy, comes out.
And there is this story that he tried to buy all the prints of the film because he was so shocked when he saw his beautiful young wife being looked at lustfully by the millions. But there's also the possibility that that was a publicity stunt arranged by Hedy and Fritz to increase awareness. Who knows?
Either way, we do know that their marriage was not a super happy one. Shockingly, an amoral weapons manufacturer could be a bit controlling. So Hedy, she made her escape.
So she apparently swapped places with her maid, dressed up as her maid, shimmied out the bedroom window with a bag of jewels, hopped on a train out of Austria and left the country. And that was the end of the marriage to Fritz Mandl, although they didn't actually divorce until much later.
Let's talk about the social circles that they kept when they were married, because this is a really interesting point. You've got this young actress at dinner parties run by an arms manufacturer. Who is she being exposed to in these rooms? Because it must have been a very different world for her.
Yes, it was. I mean, certainly Mussolini. The rumour was Hitler, but that's absolutely not. It's not even feasible that Hitler would have been at these dinner parties. But Mussolini, yes. Mussolini and Fritz Mandl were close. And also other leaders of the Austrian Fascist Party. So these were high-end politicians and businessmen.
At these dinner parties, the conversation would, understandably, turn to war and weaponry. There'd be talk of torpedoes and radio controls and signal jamming. And all of this is information that Hedwig just filed away for later. As anti-Semitism spreads throughout Austria, Hedwig and Fritz realise they need to escape. He flees to Argentina while she makes her way to America.
She had actually engineered herself to be on the same ship as Louis B. Mayer going to Hollywood.
So So Louis B. Mayer is a huge deal. He was a film producer, the co-founder of MGM Studios. And under his direction, MGM became one of Hollywood's most prestigious movie studios.
And she'd done this by pretending to be the governess to a child violinist prodigy.
Oh my God, this is amazing.
She was a fine actor in many ways. And so eventually this kind of circle around Louis B. Mayer says this rather beautiful woman just hanging out. And so it's on board the ship that she actually signs the contract with Louis B. Mayer that allows her entry into Hollywood. So by the time the ship docks, she is already being groomed to be a Hollywood star. So she's had this kind of makeover on the ship. She's dressed in much more glamorous clothing. She looks more like a star than a refugee. And then from there on, it's a fine line because Louis B. Mayer wants her to be seen as sexy, but he doesn't want her to be seen as scandalous. And also he's going to absolutely play down the Jewishness. And so really from this point onwards, there's no more mention of her being Jewish.
Cue movie makeover montage.
He also wanted to conform much more to the kind of notion of Hollywood beauty. So she's put on a diet. And of course, she's made to learn English. She did speak some English, but she didn't speak like many of the emigres. It was very heavily accented. There's all this prep going on when she arrives to make her ready for the American public as someone who has got a slightly mysterious background, is sexy, but isn't scandalous.
And to further distance her from any scandal, they change her name from Hedwig Kiesler to Hedy Lamarr. Now, firstly, it's to remove any connection to that controversial movie Ecstasy, but also they're paying homage to a silent film star, Barbara Lamarr, who had also been called the most beautiful woman in the world in her prime. But after the makeover and the name change, MGM, they kind of struggle to find any roles for Hedy. So they essentially end up renting her out.
This is classic Hollywood studio practice. You have these stars on your books, they're contracted to you, but you rent them out, basically. You let them out. And so another studio pays for their time, or you swap them with a star from another studio that you want. So Louis B. Mayer lets her out to an independent producer called Walter Wanger, himself an emigre. And he is making this film called Algiers.
And it is in this film that Hedy Lamarr really debuts to the world as a stunning film star.
She looks amazing, the lighting. But the main thing is she's got this sort of middle parting now. She's got this little jewel in her forehead. Her lips are absolutely ruby red. She's just extraordinary looking in this film. And this is the film that made her because it really cemented her as a European exotic.
So as this Hollywood stuff is happening, the war is heating up. And, you know, by her background, she's connected to this unfolding horror in Europe. And she wanted to be involved and help in some way, shape or form.
So what was happening was the Europeans were meeting for lunches and meeting in each other's homes and saying, what can we do? There are incredible rescue stories, people rescuing whole villages and saying they're all actors and giving them sort of fakey contracts and visas.
But Hedy couldn't help out with fake visas, so she wielded a power she did have, her beauty.
There was a very famous fundraising venue called the Hollywood Canteen, and their returning GIs would come and they could dance with Hollywood film stars. It was really a boost for the troops. So that was one aspect of what she did. The other was she went on this bond train around America, which was to sell war bonds, right? So they want public to buy war bonds to invest in the American war effort. And she was a huge part of that. And she raised literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for the American war effort. And she'd sell a kiss. You could buy a kiss with Hedy Lamarr for, you know, X many thousand dollars or whatever it was. And that money went to buying war bonds. So in a very kind of public way, she put her by now quite considerable celebrity to use for the Allies. But then, of course, she wanted to do something else too.
So here's the thing. Hedy Lamarr, Hedwig, it seems, was always a bit of a nerd on the side.
So one of the things about her was that she loved inventing. It was just a part of her character, a part of her creativity. And so apparently when she was on set, you know, even in the early days of her Hollywood career, she always had a separate area where she would conduct experiments. And so she was always trying to invent this, trying to invent that.
And she was tinkering with an idea that could help the Allied war effort on a more strategic frontline level than just selling kisses for war bonds.
You know, it's the early wartime period. America has entered the war. The Germans are winning the sea battles. And the Germans, they had these very effective U-boats, they were underwater, and they were torpedoing some very, very famous liners were torpedoed by the Germans, and some sinking with massive loss of life.
A U-boat, by the way, is a German military submarine, undersea boat, hence U-boat.
So this was a crisis for the Allies because the Germans were better at it. So they needed a way for the Allies to locate and sink these German U-boats. The Allies had very, very poor communication systems, so that they would try to send a missile from one of their own ships, but it was sent, you know, using radio waves. It was directed using radio waves, but they were totally easy for the Germans to find and jam, and so the missile never struck the U-boat.
So Hedy had this idea, right? How do you project a missile from an Allied boat to hit the German U-boat, but always maintain control of the missile so that the Germans cannot jam it?
And so she was working on this in her head, and then she goes to a party and she meets this very well-known at the time, perhaps slightly forgotten now, American modernist composer called George Antheil. And they worked out that the way a player piano works, which is an electric piano, that you preset the score and it turns. You've got a little cylinder that turns and plays the music. So you're not actually pressing the keys yourself. It's been programmed. And if you have two of these player pianos in sync with each other, one is sending via radio waves the tune to the other. But it's jumping the keys the whole time because that's how a piano works. You're, you know, playing different keys. So you've got the radio signals are constantly jumping, which makes them almost impossible to jam. Because unless you have the code and you know the tune, fundamentally, which the Germans would not, then it couldn't be intercepted.
So essentially what Hedy and George figured out by playing the piano was a concept known as frequency hopping, where radio signals hop around a frequency, but they do so in a pattern, making it impossible to intercept, jam, or interfere with.
And they developed it and they developed it and they developed it on the floor of his apartment. They were using matches, matchsticks, and so on, until they got it right. And they worked out that this is the way to sink U-boats.
You can imagine their excitement, right? They're pulling all these all-nighters to figure out how to protect the Allies from German submarines. And so they take their idea to the Inventors Council to get it patented.
It got some publicity, but kind of the mocking kind. Oh, ha, ha. Beautiful Hollywood film star patents designed to sink German U-boats. Ha, ha. Because, of course, you couldn't be clever and beautiful at the same time.
The US patent gives it the title of secret communication system, which is kind of the key thing here. It's not necessarily about what's being communicated. It's the mechanics of how it's being communicated, that the frequency will hop at an interval that both the receiver and the sender can register and no one else can interrupt because it's hopping at the same intervals. And that's why it's important and that's why it's distinctive. I'm just so intrigued about what happens when she goes to talk to like the US Navy or somebody who can use it, right? Because the origin of the idea is to defend against U-boats. So when she rocks up to the US Navy and says, hi, this can help, what sort of reaction does Hedy Lamarr get?
Oh, she's laughed at, you know. I mean, they kind of, I think they probably saw it as something of a publicity coup. Beautiful Hollywood film star develops patent to save the US. They understood that it was feasible, right? Because otherwise she wouldn't have got the patent. I mean, there are many, many, many people want to patent their inventions and most people never do. So in a sense, they did get it. But these are older American men faced with this incredibly glamorous film star trailing in her wake, a modernist composer, and saying, I've sorted it, guys.
So Hedy and George were dismissed pretty much on face value, but their idea wasn't entirely swept away. It was held onto and filed away.
There's no doubt that people were looking at it. They were thinking about it. They were not saying to Hedy Lamarr, we're thinking about it. She was not getting any money from it, which I think she would have really, really valued. But they didn't altogether forget about it. And then, of course, subsequently it gets brushed down, it gets modified, and it is used in, for instance, in defending America in the Bay of Pigs. And ultimately, we're skipping through many transformations of this invention. It becomes the basis for Wi-Fi.
So let's talk about that, because the dots on the map between the fundamental principle of what George and Hedy crafted and Wi-Fi has always been sort of like gushed out. And I've never really understood the mechanics of how we get from one to the other. So let's start with this. So the idea kind of gets shelved for a while, but then it sort of resurfaces. How does it resurface throughout the decades?
It resurfaces, first of all, in a way for, again, in military usage. So the first usage of it is still military. It's still the Navy. And they're using it for sonar buoys, which are missiles that you drop on the ocean to detect other shipping in the area. It then, after the patent has lapsed, late 50s, into the 60s. And what starts to happen in the 60s is digitization. So obviously this was initially analog because it couldn't have been anything else. Once people start moving into the computer era, which of course the military do much, much earlier than say we did as consumers, then it takes on a very different meaning because you can do so much more when you digitize a sound wave than when it's an analog signal. So once it's a digital signal, it's got so much more power, if you like, and so much more bandwidth.
Okay, so it's that move to computers, the move to digitization that really gets people looking at this idea again.
And of course, the point of Wi-Fi, which is such a basic consumer usage now, is that I can WhatsApp you and it's end-to-end encrypted. Somebody cannot jam, somebody cannot break into my communication with you. And that's what Wi-Fi needed. Otherwise, it would have been chaos. Can you imagine? So it's this notion of end-to-end encrypted, which we're very familiar with, that comes all the way from that invention, which is how does one instrument speak to another instrument without somebody intercepting the message?
So a lot of this development, building on her idea, is happening way from her. She has no idea it's happening. Meanwhile, just talk to me a little bit about what happens with her career, because her career kind of, it changes shape pretty drastically, both personally and professionally, after the height of her Hollywood career.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very classic sort of fall from grace story and very typical of Hollywood then, and actually not so completely strange to us now, which was that, okay, so the war is over, we're moving into the 50s, it's a very different America, we're moving into the kind of era of Marilyn Monroe and a different type of American film star. She's also, quote unquote, aging, which is, oh my God, she's in her late 30s.
Heavens.
Wow. That's a crisis. So the roles were not there for her. She did do something really, really interesting too, though, after the end of her Hollywood career, which is that she set up her own production company. And again, this is not something that most film stars did. She was doing it way before others thought of it. She makes two films, one of which is actually pretty successful and makes money. The second one ran into huge problems around censorship and overrun of costs and mismanagement and so on. So she only made the two films, but even still, to set up your own production company shows a kind of ambition that, she's not just a pretty face, right?
Fast forward now to the 1990s. We're in the Wi-Fi era. It's the rise of tech bros and Silicon Valley. And it's becoming well known that Hedy Lamarr, that black and white film star from 50 years ago, was the person who invented the foundation of this technology. And suddenly, after years of wanting recognition, Hedy gets it.
And I think, a number of things happen. One is that the tech industry kind of needs her too. They needed somebody who wasn't a geek to be the face of their industry. And they suddenly discovered, no shit, Hedy Lamarr. And so she's getting newspaper coverage and she's getting her picture in the front of journals again. And suddenly, she would have been totally forgotten about in terms of her stardom. But this story emerges and it's so amazing. Money starts to come in from the invention. And then she gets this acknowledgement from a group, ESF, it's the Electronic Science Frontier, and they make this public acknowledgement of her part in the evolution of technology by presenting her with an award. Now, at this stage, she's really quite elderly, she's reclusive, there's no way she's going to go to a big convention and accept an award. So her son, Tony Loder, goes and he goes up to the stage to accept the award. And she rings him because she was a compulsive phoner. She loved mobile phones. So he's standing up on the platform saying, Mum, I'm actually in public now, accepting your award. And then she's recorded a message saying, I'm very glad that at last people have recognised my invention.
Ruth, I've been wanting to do an episode about Hedy Lamarr forever. all of the amazing details of her life. It really comes to life. And Ruth, I just cannot thank you enough for making the time to talk to us on the other side of the world.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Mark. It's a real pleasure.
Ruth Barton is an Emeritus Professor of Film at Trinity College Dublin. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf. Our lovely sound engineer was Tim Jenkins, and I'm Mark Fennell. No One Saw It Coming. It is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. Now, before I leave you, a couple of names really important for you to hear. Eleanor, Ali, Justin and Stuart. Why are they special? Well, they are the people that emailed us noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au and said, hey, Hedy Lamarr, perfect episode of the show. And you know what? They were right. If you've got an idea, a name, just a half-baked thought that you think might be worth looking into, you know the deal. Just send us an email, noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. And while you're at it, send this episode to somebody you know right now over Wi-Fi and thank Hedy Lamarr. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.